are in an emergency with geographic income levels, housing prices, complete with over 3 gigabytes of detailed information on the 3,000-plus counties in the U.S., full-color photographs, 550 high-resolution full-color maps, and detailed information and analysis that you need. Order Prudent Places USA now for only $29, plus shipping, by calling New Millennium at 888-803-4438 and tell them Alex Jones sent you. That's 888-803-4438.
understand that the economy was going to turn bad probably at the beginning of this year.
Well, of course, actually in Vallejos, my understanding, about 75% of the entire budget of the city is for police and fire.
Exactly.
And, of course, they, you know, the public service union actually helps to elect the politicians so they will give the police and firemen higher wages. And 75% of their budget is going there. And there's no money for anything else. They've got a $16 million budget deficit and no money to pay things with. And they have actually gone into bankruptcy.
Yeah, and this is something that people have been looking to happen for a while, and when the shoe dropped the other day, it didn't surprise those of us who have been looking at these.
Hold that thought, we'll be right back. And of course, our guest this afternoon is William Grigg, and we're going to be talking about really what's happening financially to our society. Now, William is the former senior editor of the New American Magazine. He is, at present time, working with the Wells Foundation. He's writing, and we carry his book, Liberty and Eclipse. We also, of course, have him on a couple of times a week on our programs. He is certainly one of the most articulate spokesmen for the conservative pro-American cause. And basically we were talking about the fact that the city of Vallejo has just declared bankruptcy. Why? Why? Because, of course, they were putting out so much money for salaries for policemen and firemen who kept demanding more and more and more. 75% of the entire budget of the city was going simply to the police and firemen, and then the rest of it, of course, for other public employees. And with the declining income that Vallejo and other cities are having, why, I think this is simply foreshadows a lot of our cities are going to be going bankrupt. And the only way, of course, to correct this is to begin laying off people. And then you're going to see the people demonstrating. The teachers are going to be demonstrating. The police are going to, and firemen are going to go out on strike and say, you're going to die. There's not going to be any protection for fires. Give us more money. And the trouble is that there really isn't any more money to give. William, pick up the story there.
Of course, we're anticipating some very predictable developments here in terms of the likely outcome being a number of labor actions of the sort you're describing. What I think is amusing is that every time you have a budget impasse of this sort, whether it takes place at the municipal level or the federal level, you always find people arranging to put out first on the firing line those really high-profile, marquee, charismatic, if you will, services of government that people consider to be indispensable. You know, rather than going out and finding somebody who's a third adjunct bookkeeper to some gratuitous bureaucratic entity and deciding to cut that job out of the budget, they'll put something that's really popular in the community up on the chopping block first, maybe a school music program, maybe a high school sports program of some sort. So that's the first thing that has to go. And that's, of course, a way that they can get some public sympathy on the side of the so-called public service unions here, public servant unions. And you have labor actions of that sort where people who are part of the first responder community, as they call themselves, fire and police officials, hazardous materials specialists, emergency responders, talking about all the things that are going to happen in terms of children who are going to die or old people will be left without protection and things of that sort. What I really think is interesting, if you go back to the 1995-1996 budget impasse in Washington, where suddenly we were told that because of the refusal of the Republican-led Congress that came into power in 1995.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment with William Grigg here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William is simply pointing out how they play on our sympathy. Watch television. Why they say, oh, they're cutting back on money. They're taking away the education of the children. Shouldn't we be helping the children? And we've got to, of course, maintain our small class size. We don't want to cut back on the music program. We don't want to cut back on the library. The trouble is there isn't any money.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, they talk about, oh, my goodness, how will we get by without policemen and firemen? And, ladies and gentlemen, we don't have the money, and we are moving into a real financial crisis. But notice how the television programs will play on your sympathy. It's always the children, the children, the children, the children. Mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness, we got to protect our children. But, of course, what it's really all about is ever larger salaries for the bureaucracy. And believe me, they're not going to cut back on the administrative salaries. They're going to play on your sympathy to try to get you to vote for more taxes. And I don't think people are going to vote for more taxes because, of course, people are overstressed today. Their incomes are going down. People are losing their jobs. We've already had last year 1,500,000 people had their houses foreclosed. Already in the first quarter of this year, over 650 50,000 people have had their houses go into foreclosure, and we're talking perhaps between 8 and 10 million Americans are going to lose their homes, and with that, of course, will come the declining value of homes and then declining of income of the state, county, and municipal governments, and they're going to have to start, you know, doing away with all the excessive jobs that they have. The biggest employer in the world, in the United States today, is government by far.
That's
go
exactly
ahead.
Exactly right. And you talk about the fact that these people are losing their homes to foreclosure. What is happening is that people, of course, end up upside down. They owe more on their homes, on their mortgage, than their homes are worth under current market assessments. But the big problem here that compounds that situation for a lot of people who are homeowners only in an aspirational sense, meaning that the banks still own their homes because the mortgages aren't paid off. Many people find that they are driven into foreclosure by virtue of the fact that there is a time lag between a tax assessment and the market assessment of your home. The market assessment of your home will decline and put you in a position of negative equity far sooner than the tax assessment will go down to match what your current subjective home value would be. That's something that started to happen up in northern Idaho about a year and a half ago. A number of people found out that they still owed property tax at a level congruent with the previous inflated market value of their home, that they had dropped down 10, 15, 20% in some cases, leaving these people completely in an unsustainable position financially. That's driving a lot of the foreclosure here in the West, in a lot of these places where the market had been incendiary for real estate. And now that the market has cooled off and you're seeing these inflated prices come down, the tax assessment remains that high, but the subjective value of the property has declined. And so that creates a feedback loop here where communities like Vallejo, who had expanded their public sector in just a metastatic way, just a cancerous growth of the public sector there in that community and a number of other communities in the Bay Area in California, and now that the real estate market has tumbled and these property tax assessments have started to go down, they're taking a look at revenue projections into the future, and it's obvious that they're not going to be able to get as much revenue out of people on the basis of property taxes as they had projected. And the last thing they're going to do, as you point out, is to start cutting salaries and start laying people off. I mean, the closest thing to permanent job security in the world is to work for a government anywhere in this country. So what they're going to do, in addition to these labor actions we've talked about and these wretched, insipid propaganda campaigns where they talk about the children and the elderly and everybody else who's vulnerable in society being left out in the cold because of the heartlessness of taxpayers, they're going to have to find new sources of revenue. If they can't get revenue from the state government, of course, the California state government's just as bankrupt as Vallejo or any of these other municipalities. If they can't get it from the federal government, they're going to have to find new ways of wheedling the money out of people who produce things for a living, which means they're going to have to start using that police force, that overgrown and overcompensated police force, as a shakedown squad. This is something else we've been talking about for about a year or so, how these quality of life ordinances and laws and regulations are going to become a real important source of revenue for communities as the economic collapse accelerates. And that's something that we've already seen happen in the Midwest, and it's starting to happen out here in the western United States and the Rocky Mountain states as well. Here in Idaho, we don't have ordinance enforcement anywhere near as big a problem. They're not nearly as zealous in enforcing those ordinances and those codes out here as they are in some other communities, but what they have done is they've started campaigns against what they call aggressive driving. Talk about a perfect example of a so-called crime of perception. Aggressive driving is anything that the police officer considers to be excessively aggressive. You're not necessarily in a situation where somebody violates a hard and fast black letter driving ordinance. It's just that the police officer thinks that maybe you were just a little bit too eager to pass somebody. Maybe you passed somebody just a little bit too quickly. Maybe you displayed what he perceives to be indifference to the needs of other drivers on the road. You're not speeding necessarily. You're not driving without your seatbelt fastened. You're not driving a car with a taillight out or a brake light out or in any other way violating a definable ordinance in the code. You're just doing something that the police officers considers to be too aggressive. That's something which is really sweeping here across Idaho. And in large measure, this is something being abetted through the use of seed money from the federal government to pay for overtime in order for the police to go out and write these spurious tickets that are going to be used to enhance the revenue stream of a lot of these communities that are right now a little bit revenue anemic. And that's a really good example of how the federal government has taken over control, effectively, of our so-called local police agencies. Because when, for the most part, you have these enforcement actions, whether they're for seat belt and car seat inspections, or for drunk driving, or now for aggressive driving or other purposes, there are block grants which are given to the states for the purpose of paying overtime for police, and some element of those block grants will filter down to municipal police agencies, and they'll use those in these enforcement actions that are nothing more than an elaborate scheme to mulct the public of revenue in order to keep these overgrown municipal governments well-fed, keep the employees who are on the payroll fat and happy, and to make sure that they're somewhat secure as the rest of us find ourselves impecuniated by the ongoing economic collapse. It really is a nasty game. And the other thing that we should look forward to, not with a sense of eagerness, but with a sense of foreboding, is the possibility that we're going to see a lot more Kelo-style acts of eminent domain in the name of urban renewal, or as they call it out in California, redevelopment. And this, of course, is a very familiar gambit where a municipal government will sit as a urban renewal board, or as they call it in California, a redevelopment board, and then declare an area of the city to be blighted, and then to take control of it through eminent domain and try to attract somebody who's a Fortune 500 company or somebody of a similar stratum economically, to come and take the property into develop it as a way of enhancing the revenue base of a community. And from what I learned a couple of weeks ago, a lecture was given at the United Republicans of California Spring Convention on this subject, and apparently a municipal government, in certain circumstances, when it's carrying out these projects and redevelopment, can go out into the capital markets and borrow 13 times the amount of the projected revenue that would come in from a redevelopment project of this sort, for a certain period of time. And of course, by doing so, they're putting future taxpayers on the hook for immediate revenue now. And that's a perfectly good arrangement for people who are in government. They don't have to worry about that. Once again, we're talking about tax consumers here. We're talking about the consumers of wealth, not the producers of wealth. So there are all kinds of things that they can do to defer accountability here and to redistribute accountability onto the shoulders of those of us who are simply trying to earn a living and to retain some portion of what we have made through our honest efforts in our industry.
And, of course, what's really so frightening about the taking away people's property? Well, suddenly you want to give it to a developer, you know. Maybe it's a friend of yours. Maybe he donated your campaign. You're going to vote for that. And, of course, this is the way the game is really played. And, of course, the Supreme Court said this is a state affair, and I really believe it is. Certainly we have legislation on the ballot here in the state of California, Proposition 98, to stop that. And you should see all the things that they're putting out. The newspapers are all against Proposition 98. All of the establishment is against Proposition 98. Why? Because it would protect the right of the people to their property, and you just couldn't take it away on a whim of a board of supervisors or a city council. You know, to benefit their friends and their political supporters. And what we need, of course, I hope here in California, Proposition 98 will pass. But, of course, that is the last thing the establishment wants. They want the ability to take away your property. Now, of course, they'd be horrified if we take away their property, but, of course, they do not believe in the right of private property, and yet, of course, our founding fathers did, because private property is the very essence of freedom, and without a right to private property, property that can be taken away at any time by the king, or by the county board of supervisors, or certainly by the city council, for their benefit and the benefit of their friends, or they can think it's a good idea, they take away a right of private property. They've taken away one of the foundations of our freedom.
Well, their philosophy is best summarized in the phrase, what's mine is mine and what's yours is ours.
Right.
The thing that I think is important to recognize about the Kelo decision, this is something I didn't realize until about a year and a half ago, and I studied it a little bit more carefully, is that although it was framed as a state's rights issue, the specific development there, and I believe it was the state of Delaware or Connecticut? It was either Delaware or Connecticut. But the specific development actually had a federal subsidy. There was a federal program involved in helping to subsidize the building of this, I believe it was a pharmaceutical manufacturing plant in this particular township that involved seizing private property from a number of people against their will. because this is done to benefit a discrete, definable, specific private interest that had political connections, which, of course, is not what the eminent domain principle is all about. I have a real problem with the so-called power of eminent domain to begin with. I think it's a bad idea, as it's contained, as it's phrased in the Constitution. That's one of two things I would actually have changed about the Constitution. But even so, this is a clear-cut case where, for the benefit of a private interest, not for the public good, however defined, for the benefit of a private interest in a position to kick back to politically connected cronies, they were seizing property.
And, of course, that was the Pfizer company. We'll be back here in just a moment with William Grigg talking about, of course, their takeaway of right to private property for the politician's sake. Well, this is Dr. Sten. Go right ahead, William. Pick the story up there.
One of the things that we saw here in the case of the Kayla decision, where the property, or rather the principle of eminent domain, was being used in a manifestly corrupt way in order to benefit Pfizer and some other people who had attached themselves to Pfizer as so-called public servants, is we've seen the corruption of, or rather we have seen manifest, the corruption of local police into what you'd almost have to call a strong arm entity, a strong arm unit on behalf of a corrupt municipal authority. And this is something that represents, I think, or that illustrates a really important change that has taken place in our entire law enforcement culture. I really believe that, say, a generation ago, or maybe even half a generation ago, say, somewhere between 25 and 30 years ago, you would have seen a lot of police officers having really serious problems of conscience in carrying out the orders of a municipal government that were so manifestly corrupt as to use this power of eminent domain to kick people off their property in order to benefit politically connected corporate interests. But there has been a very dramatic change in the culture of law enforcement in this country in ways that I think are serious and lamentable. And that's, of course, one of the main themes of my book, Liberty and Eclipse, and it's one of the things I blog about quite a bit on my blog, Pro Libertate. And just yesterday, I posted an essay talking about a really interesting case in Baltimore involving a fellow by the name of Norman Stamp. He's a 65-year-old man. About a week and a half ago, was shot dead during an altercation at a southeastern Baltimore bar called Haven Place. Now, Mr. Stamp was the co-founder of a motorcycle gang, or a motorcycle club, as they prefer to be called, known as the Chosen Sons. And he was there with his comrades from that motorcycle club celebrating the initiation of a new member of their club, and there was a dispute over the attentions of a couple of females that escalated into a fist fight. The police were called. At one point, as the police were trying to break up the tussle, Mr. Stamp came boiling out of the bar with his brass knuckles on, and the police officer tased him, put him on the ground. And after Norman Stamp recovered from this, he got up, reached for a gun that he had in his pocket, and he was shot dead by this police officer. The last words that escaped the lips of Norman Stamp were, "I'm a cop." The police officer who shot Mr. Stamp didn't know that Mr. Stamp was an off-duty police officer. He was a 44-year veteran of the police department in Baltimore, which is a very troubled department, one of the more troubled departments in the country. They are providing a steady stream of really lurid and infuriating video clips to YouTube and some of these other file-sharing sites online, displaying in repugnant detail some really conspicuous examples of abuse of power by police officers. Every time I turn around, the Baltimore PD has enriched that large and growing literature of police abuse on video. And so now we have a case where one Baltimore police officer shoots a second one, not knowing that the person on the receiving end of that gunshot was also an off-duty police officer. He was a 44-year veteran of the police force. He's about a 40-year veteran of this motorcycle gang he belonged to. What's really interesting is that a few days later, they had a funeral, a police funeral for Norman Stamp, and of course you had all of the ritual and ceremony that accompany police funerals today, which seem to be more like military funerals than the funerals for civilian peace officers, which is what you would expect. You expect the latter. I mean, they're supposed to be peace officers who are civilians,
right? Hold that thought. We'll be right back with William Grigg here. Well, Dr. stand here, our guest is William Gregg, and we're certainly talking about the excesses sometimes of the police. And William was just talking about an incident that occurred back in Baltimore, where, of course, a man who headed a motorcycle gang got drunk and into a bar fight and eventually, you know, was tasered and went down and apparently had brass knuckles on. You know, why would a man have brass knuckles? Obviously, he wants to do a great deal of harm. Well, after he has been tasered, he stands up and, of course, the police officer says something to him. He reaches into his pocket where he has a gun and the officer shoots him. And the man is amazed. He says, I'm a police officer, and he drops dead.
Yeah.
And this is, of course, what happens, unfortunately, when you have police officers, you know, who are unruly, who do not agree to the law. Why would a police officer be in a bar having a fight? Why would he be having brass knuckles? Why would he begin to pull a gun on a officer who is on duty? And this was an off-duty police officer. And then, of course, he's honored as this great fallen hero, and he's simply a thug.
It really is quite an incomprehensible concatenation of events here. It's the sort of thing that you wouldn't believe if you saw it in a screenplay or saw it on a television show, but there it is.
And we see this with the Pennsylvania, the Philadelphia police force.
Oh, yeah.
They're simply always beating up somebody or killing somebody indiscriminately, and nothing's ever done about it. And
well,
you wonder why some of the blacks feel that they're being put upon, and I believe they are being put upon.
They probably are. I mean, since the days of Mayor Rizzo, Philadelphia has been in bad odor with people of whatever place on the political spectrum they find themselves who are concerned about civil liberties. It's not just people who cling to the left end of the spectrum and believe that civil liberties are violated if you send an actual criminal to prison. I mean, there are people who espouse that point of view. Neither you nor I qualify for that description. There are people who believe that you have to follow due process before you send somebody to prison, and hopefully that's a category, rather, that would include everybody who's concerned about public affairs. But there are some people who believe that any time you send a criminal to prison, even if you approve beyond a reasonable doubt after following all the proper due process procedures, there are people who believe that person is somehow a victim of society because we're not addressing the root causes of his actions because, well, quite frankly, we're not living in an overtly socialist society, at least according to their taste. Neither you or I would be considered that type of a so-called civil libertarian, but there are people who are concerned about civil liberties who for many years and decades, in fact, have been really concerned about Philadelphia in particular because their police force there, as is the case, unfortunately, with the NYPD, for a long, long time has been really riddled with corruption in a way that seems to be almost incurable. And the same is true, unfortunately, the Baltimore Police Department, which is the force for which Norman Stamp served for 44 years. And the really interesting thing about this paramilitary funeral that is now, as I mentioned, part of the standard ritual whenever a police officer meets an untimely end, the one that was held for Norman Stamp was really interesting because in addition to having the Baltimore police out in force in dress uniforms, you had hundreds and hundreds of members of various motorcycle gangs who were there as well out in their uniforms. All of them were wearing the standard leather jacket or denim jacket with the patch insignia of their various affiliations. And I thought that was a really interesting spectacle here because you had somebody who joined these two worlds. The press accounts that I've read of this all focus on the idea that Norman Stamp was really quite an anomalous figure because he somehow managed to bridge these two very disparate worlds. On the one hand, he was a member of Baltimore's finest, and on the other hand, he was part of this outlaw biker milieu. And supposedly these worlds have nothing to do with each other. The point I made in my essay is actually those two worlds have become very, very close over the last 25 or 30 years, unfortunately, as the police have been militarized and indoctrinated in an us-versus-them mindset, with the public at large being them, they have become more thuggish, and there are ways in which the underworld has become more copish, if you will, in terms of using certain types of high-tech equipment and following surveillance methods and intelligence methods that have been used by the police. But the thing that we need to recognize here is that line, that boundary at one point had been a very large gulf. There was a huge gulf that separated the police in the LAPD in the 1960s from biker gangs. I mean, that was a big gulf in terms of the way people dressed when they were members of the LAPD, the type of moral background they had, the type of integrity they displayed, the character expectations everything from grooming to deportment to the way that they address people, they were completely different from the type of folks you would find in outlaw motorbike gangs. And now, of course, that gulf has been narrowed to the point where it's a very thin and very shallow line. And so somebody like a Norman Stamp can have one foot in both camps and consider himself to be perfectly suitable as a representative of the public wheel wearing the uniform of Boston or Baltimore's police department. You mentioned the Philadelphia Police Department. Just in the last couple of days, there's been this video which has made the rounds of the Internet showing this incident from Monday night when something like 15 or 16 police officers were decanted from their vehicles in a traffic stop, and three teenage suspects were hauled out of a car, and you had five or six police officers swarming each one of these prone and unresisting suspects.
Hold that back. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course, William was just talking about this, these films that are up on the Internet now. You can probably Google them in. Philadelphia police kicking incident, something of the sort. And basically, these police officers were kicking these helpless young men who were down, and were they cuffed or what? William?
Yes, the the incident took place Monday night, and according to the chief of police in Philadelphia, what happened is that on Saturday night, there was an armed robbery, and one of the suspects apparently shot and killed a police sergeant with a shotgun. And there were three suspects who were involved in this robbery, allegedly. Two of them were either caught or killed, and then a third still was at large as of Monday night. And apparently there had been a shooting somewhere in the vicinity of the incident that we're describing now involving this traffic stop. But that still doesn't explain why you'd have three teenagers dragged out of their cars. Actually, they weren't even dragged out of their cars. They got out of their cars. There was one audibly, actually. They got out of the car of their own volition, and they threw themselves flat on the ground, and they're swarmed by 16 police officers who must have known that they were being photographed because this is something that was being covered by local television and local radio. They must have known that they were on video, and yet while the cameras were rolling, these police officers descended upon these three hapless teenagers. I don't know what they were accused of doing. There was no mention of them being connected to any of these shooting incidents. But they were prone, but yet they were beaten and kicked and struck with batons repeatedly for quite a lengthy period of time, a couple of minutes. These were unresisting criminal suspects. And the police chief was asked to explain this. He said something to the effect of, well, you've got to understand, this looks really bad in terms of the excessive use of force, but the police are on edge right now because of the shooting that took place on Saturday night. Now, that's a perfectly understandable human reaction. I would understand why somebody would be a little bit on edge if somebody you've worked with and probably developed an affinity for and a friendship with had been shot and killed. You'd probably be a little bit anxious for your own safety, and no doubt you'd be rather angry and frustrated that your friend had been killed. That's a perfectly human thing. One of the things we pay police to do, however, is to develop sufficient discipline that they will not allow that to color their judgment when they're interacting with the public. That's simply part of the parcel of becoming a police officer. You're not being asked to do away with that perfectly human reaction. You're asked to put it in context and to sublimate it to such a point that you're not going to allow it to drive you to do something that is probably a criminal abuse of force. But the other thing I think is really interesting.
Hold that thought for just a moment. We'll be back in just a moment with William Grigg. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this afternoon is William Grigg. And before we get back to the story of what happened in Philadelphia, where the police brutally kicked and beat three non-resisting teenagers on the ground, and we're talking about repeated kicks and hitting with the batons, and they're just laying there helplessly on the ground. And, of course, well, they said, well, after all, a police officer was shot a few days before. No evidence these kids had anything to do with it. But, of course, it was it was just a misuse of force. And excused by the police chief and excused by the mayor of Philadelphia, oh, well, they said boys will be boys, sort of an attitude. Before we go on, William, let's go ahead and get out your blog site and how people can certainly get your information.
Well, the easiest way to get to the blog, which is entitled Pro Libertate, that's Latin, it means for freedom, is to go to the homepage of the Welch Foundation, which is called The Right Source. And the web address for that is www.rightsourceonline.com. That's one word, rightsourceonline.com. At the top of the page, if you go to The Right Source, you'll find a banner ad for my new book, which is entitled Liberty in Eclipse, The War on Terror and the Rise of the Homeland Security State. If you go down about a third of the page and look at the left-hand side of your screen, you'll find my photograph. And next to my photograph, you'll find the hot link, which will take you to my daily blog. Pro Libertate is published between three and five times a week, which is to say, between three and five times a week, I'll publish a new essay on a subject relevant to the struggle to preserve what remains of individual freedom and to rehabilitate the rule of law. I think that the supreme purpose of the rule of law, at least with respect to our government, the political element of the rule of law, is to preserve individual freedom, and any law that doesn't have that purpose is of no particular use. As a matter of fact, I contend that it's a law only in the most derivative and positivist sense of that expression. The law exists to protect our individual rights so that we can express fully the talents that God gave us so as to bring glory to God's name. That's a formula that goes all the way back to John Knox, who's actually just an ancestor of mine by adoption. He once told the Queen of England that her sole pleasure and privilege as the monarch was to make it possible, through her administration of the kingdom, for her subjects to obey God's law. And that's the ultimate objective, obviously, in preserving individual rights, is that the individual will be able, through the exercise of his gifts, to bring glory and honor to God. Now, Pro Libertate is a Christian small-l libertarian site, meaning I focus on elements of the political discourse and elements of the news that have to do with the question of human liberty, individual liberty. But I do it from the perspective of somebody who's a Christian believer. And I believe it's important to recognize that so often people assume that if you're a libertarian of whatever stripe, you're somebody who's interested primarily in those types of individual behaviors that are dissolute and degrading, abortion, drug use, pornography, things of that sort. I don't champion any of those things, any of those vices. I don't think that that's by any means congruent with or synonymous with the cause of individual liberty. What I try to help people understand, however, is that anytime we empower the government to enforce a certain law or to carry out a certain task, we're doing so in a way that derogates from individual liberty. There are certain things government should be able to do. I believe that they should have only those powers necessary to preserve life, liberty, and property. And that when government transcends that, it's getting out of line. When government becomes proactive rather than reactive, it's becoming tyrannical. And unfortunately, when you apply that perspective to what's going on in our country right now, you never run out of things to complain about. I tend to be something of an inexhaustible fountain of complaint, and that's because I'm trying to apply that perspective to what the governments that rule us do practically every day. And the Right Source, as I mentioned before, is the homepage of the Welch Foundation. It is a news portal. We provide links to stories of interest and also to commentaries and video clips and audio clips that we think are worthwhile. The Right Source does carry my book, as does Radio Liberty. Liberty in Eclipse is about 300 pages long, and it's an examination of the various ways that our law enforcement and political culture have been altered from our Republican foundations into what you have to describe as nothing less than an embryonic Reich or empire, where we have a centralized and militarized law enforcement system that is under the control of a completely lawless executive branch. It doesn't really matter who is elected this November. He or she, when inaugurated in January, will inherit the sprawling apparatus of coercion and social regimentation, a lot of it built and refined during the two terms of the Bush administration, and will pick up seamlessly from his or her predecessor. And they will inherit a law enforcement system from which has been banished a lot of the due process guarantees and protections that we've simply taken for granted as part of our heritage. We no longer have the habeas corpus guarantee. We no longer have the right to a trial. We no longer have the right to avoid summary detention, which is what habeas corpus is all about. We have a government now that is inured to the use of torture as a way of obtaining information including self-incriminating information from terrorist suspects. Good grief, if the government can torture, what's the purpose of having a trial to begin with? The government can create its own evidence by extracting self-incriminating testimony of whatever value from a subject, from the suspect, then there's no point in having a trial. That's the system we're living under right now. It's a system that is so much worse in so many fundamental ways than the one against which our colonial forebears rebelled, that it simply beggars the imagination that we could even call ourselves Americans, having allowed this monstrosity to take root among us.
And I think it's important for our listeners to read the Military Commission Act, to understand what the Military Commission Act that was passed back in 2006 really says. And, of course, it says it'll never apply to American citizens. Well, they did it with Padilla. You know, he was an American citizen, whether you like him or not. He had no right of habeas corpus. They kept him, you know, imprisoned, and certainly, for all intents and purposes, what would be considered torture for a period of 4 or 5 years before they finally brought him to trial, and by this time, of course, psychologically had been destroyed. And of course, they used all sorts of tricks to get him convicted. There really was no proof of that at all. It was a kangaroo court. But the fact that the right of habeas corpus has been suspended for American citizens in the name, of course, of fighting terrorism, that should frighten everybody out there in the listening audience. And most people have never even read the Military Commission Act, or know that certainly after that, there were two pieces of legislation at the same time. One was the John Warner Defense Appropriation Act, and the other was the Military Commission Act. And the Vermont senator, Senator Leahy, a liberal senator, said this is a blueprint for dictatorship. And not a word in the regular media. Hardly anybody even knows what the Military Commission Act is, but it's the law of our land, passed by our Congress and signed by our president.
Exactly. It's the sort of a thing, really, that once again puts one in the mind of really bad adventure fiction. It's like one of the lesser offerings by Tom Clancy in terms of what's happened to our country. There is a novel that came out in the mid-90s called Executive Orders that posited a scenario that was not all that different from 9/11. He ended up with the president essentially ruling by decree because the Congress had been wiped out in a terrorist attack that destroyed the Capitol. And basically all that was left was a president who had just been inaugurated, who'd just taken the oath of office, and a handful of second or third echelon executive branch officials who had to reconstruct the entire federal government. And what's happened since 9/11, really, is that we've not been deprived of a Congress or a Supreme Court or these other institutions that are supposed to counterbalance the executive branch. But George W. Bush, and more importantly, Dick Cheney, the guy who's actually behind George W. Bush pulling the strings, they've actually managed to convince the public and most of the Congress that they might as well be ruling in the absence of a Congress. The Congress might as well have been done away with, either by either through annihilation in a terrorist attack, or simply by resignation or being dismissed, because we've created a situation where all power basically inheres in the executive right now, and the Congress has a vestigial function at best of simply ratifying whatever it is that the imperial executive decrees. But this is the type of an attitude that does tend to precipitate down to state and local law enforcement. And one of the things that's happened that I write about in the book that is increasingly evident with every passing day is that the state and local police bodies that were once supposed to be autonomous and locally accountable are affiliates of this Homeland Security state. But this attitude does trickle down to state and local law enforcement, and it gets to the point where they're talking about themselves as first responders of the Homeland Security system. That's an attitude that started to take root in 2002, and it really coalesced in 2003. And now, even in a town the size of Payette, Idaho, which is where I live, it's on the western border of Idaho, right next to Oregon. It's 7,000 people, and it's very rustic. It's in Idaho, which is a very minimalist government type of a state, a very Republican, a very conservative Republican. I mean, to be Republican is not necessarily to be conservative, but here in Idaho it's considered to be pretty much coterminous. But here we're having the Apple Blossom Festival this week, and the theme is to exalt our first responders, which I thought was really interesting. And the literature that's being passed up by our little city government here depicts our first responders as basically part of the Homeland Security system, which, of course, is not what they're supposed to be. They're supposed to serve this community. They're not supposed to be part of this monolith that is administered out of Washington, but that's the system we're living under. One of the points that I was going to make with respect to this growing kinship between too many police forces in this country, like that spectacle we saw in Philadelphia would illustrate, and underworld gangs is a really interesting story that came out just the last couple of days about a private gang that is the subject of a federal indictment in New York, I believe in the Bronx. What they had done is that for a number of years, they've been conducting counter-narcotics operations using exactly the same tactics and methods and technology that is being used by the feds and by federally controlled local and state counter-narcotics task forces. They would conduct surveillance of a given drug syndicate, and then they would use automobiles that were equipped with sirens and running lights to conduct traffic stops, grab these people, take them into custody, and then basically use what the Bush administration calls enhanced interrogation techniques to force these people to turn over their assets to this larger gang that was posing as police. It's really an interesting thing. According to the press clippings that came out yesterday, this gang would use such techniques as waterboarding, which is to say controlled drowning, or threats involving the use of such implements as pliers, to use these pliers to traumatize the genitalia of these criminal suspects in order to get them to reveal where the money is, where the narcotics are, and things of that sort. And, of course, this larger gang posing as police would take the money and narcotics and other assets into custody and make a killing off of it. Well, these people have been posing as police and mimicking the behavior of these federal law enforcement counter-narcotics task forces. The only difference is that they've not yet gotten to the point where they're using those methods here domestically that they have been using in counterterrorism activities by the Bush administration. We've not yet heard where police departments are using waterboarding. I mean, there are historical records. If you go back to the 20s and 30s, there are incidents where police agencies did use controlled torture, particularly after the war in the Philippines, where the so-called water cure was very commonly used as a counterinsurgency method against the Philippine insurgents. That was imported to the United States and used in a lot of police agencies until about the mid-1920s, when it was exposed by, of all the ironic things, I believe by the FBI, and also by the American Bar Association. That might be the only useful thing the ABA has ever done. But here we're seeing how this method is now part of the common conversation. People just simply treat waterboarding, that is to say water torture, controlled drowning, as simply another tool in the toolkit. The same thing with such threats as using pliers as a way of mangling, sexually disfiguring somebody, as simply another way to get somebody to cooperate. Well, you've got a gang who's gotten a little bit ahead of the curve here in terms of what our law enforcement culture is willing to countenance. But I believe that's pretty much the destination we're headed for. If you have the CIA and the FBI and other federal agencies that are involved in using torture as a means of acquiring evidence and acquiring confessions, pretty soon, I believe the time horizon is only a couple of years, we're going to find state and local police doing the same thing and doing the same thing with the positive sanction of the courts and municipal and state authorities. And so that's a line that we crossed a couple of years ago. George W. Bush has now owned up to the fact that he was apprised of everything that was being done in these far-flung secret prisons into which terrorist suspects were secreted in the name of extraordinary rendition by the CIA. The CIA had hands-on expertise applied to torturing people. Everything the CIA did was passed off and ratified by a high-ranking select committee presided over by Condoleezza Rice and George Tenet and Dick Cheney. And George W. Bush says, I was in the loop and I approved it every time. That's a public confession that he has committed crimes against our Constitution, specifically the Eighth Amendment, and also against various federal laws forbidding the use of torture.
But, of course, they will claim that, of course, these are not American citizens, so it's all right to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, of course, and after all, they are not entitled to the same protection. The Geneva Convention, because, of course, they didn't wear uniforms. And, of course, so that justifies torturing other human beings. I mean, where is the outcry from the American people?
I know. Well, the thing is, if you take a look at what happened to Jose Padilla, and I'm so glad you brought him up, he is by no means an exemplary American citizen, but he was an American citizen, still is. He was somebody who was given pretty much the full panoply of what you might call the KGB treatment, sensory deprivation, sleep deprivation. If you want to know the most effective way that the KGB found to break the will of somebody who was being tortured, it's sleep deprivation. There's a book called An American in the Gulag by Alexander Dolgin. He was taken into the custody of the Soviet secret police, which at the time was called the MGB, back in 1948. He was suspected of spying, and so he was charged under Article 58 of the Soviet Constitution, which is a broad, open-ended provision, quite a bit like what's been rammed down our throats in the name of the Patriot Act and a number of other measures in the last few years. And he was tortured for a number of months at the Lubyanka headquarters of the KGB, or MGB at the time, and then to Lefortovo, which was a satellite prison. Then he was sent to the Gulag Archipelago for 6 years. But the most effective means they found of trying to break him down, to get him to confess to something or anything, was sleep deprivation. They kept him up all day. He was not permitted to nap. He was not permitted to fall asleep. He could either stand or he could sit, but he could not sleep. He was forbidden to sleep between 6 in the morning and 10 in the evening, and then he was kept up all night being interrogated, which is to say that they worked him during the day, and then they interrogated him at night, and he maybe got 2 hours of sleep a day. This went on for week after week, month after month. That's exactly the same protocol being used in these far-flung rendition cells. It's exactly the same protocol being used in Guantanamo.
And that's exactly what they did to Jose Padilla. And the president says why we would never allow torture. And he knows exactly what they were doing. And ladies and gentlemen, you know, there is no outcry from our religious leaders. There is no outcry from our political leaders. A few of the Democrats say we should outlaw this. And the president says, you try to put that in the legislation, I'll veto it. Well, why would he veto it if we don't allow torture?
Exactly.
Where they try to outlaw torture. Well, but the thing is that the American people are going right along because it's too hard to take a stand. After all, this is not our responsibility. We aren't doing it, are we? Well, William, go right ahead and finish up. You have 3 minutes to finish the program.
Well, we may not be doing it, but to the extent that we have informed guilty knowledge of it, we are doing it. And if we do not do everything we can to stop it and to repudiate it, we pretty much will have indicted ourselves in the eyes of mankind and, more importantly, in the eyes of God. I mean, it is an offense to God that we would countenance what our government is doing in our name right now, particularly when it's being done by people who so conspicuously take the name of Christ to their lips when describing their commitments. It's something that I never imagined would be part of our daily conversation among those of us who are politically aware, that we would actually have to debate the merits of torture and explain to people why it's wrong to commission a government to do those things in our name, if not with our direct involvement. And if you leave aside the principal reasons for objecting to torture, the fact is that once the government gets the smell of blood in its nostrils, it will not discriminate when it's dealing with people who are American citizens by birth or by naturalization. That's the lesson of the Jose Padilla case. But more importantly, that's something which is simply a rational understanding of human nature. You cannot be an empire abroad and a republic at home. That knowledge is as old as Cicero or Edmund Burke, the British statesman who supported our American founding fathers in their objections against King George. And that's a lesson which is coming home to us right now, not only in terms of our badly etiolated civil liberties, but our increasingly sickly economy as well. We're paying the tangible costs every single day at the gas pump and at the cash register. If you won't pay attention to what our government is doing in terms of tearing holes in the Constitution, pay attention to what our government is doing in terms of tearing holes in your checking account. I wish I could make that clear to people, and all we can do is keep repeating these principles as clearly as possible and without cavil or censure, and I hope that at some point it's going to take fire, it's going to ignite a fire in the souls of people who still remember what it was like when our country was relatively free, and I think that there are probably more people who meet that description than I would have believed 2 or 3 years ago. But like I said, my source of optimism here is illustrated by the fact that we've got this Ron Paul movement. It's not because of Ron Paul. It's not because of who he is. It's because of what he talks about. He speaks the truth. He speaks from principle. And it's the principles that are resonating with people. That's why his book's number one on the New York Times bestseller list this week. There is some hope. It's a faint hope. It's faint hope. It's flickering hope. But hopefully it's something that's going to take root and flourish.
Well, thanks very much. Our guest has been William Greig. And, of course, we do hope that many of you will want to get his book, Liberty and Eclipse. Goodbye. Talk to you. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course I hope you enjoyed our program with William Greig, but I hope you're concerned about the torture. Our government accepts torture, our ministers refuse to speak out against it. When was the last time your minister spoke out against the torture? When was the last time your minister spoke out against the war? As in the, of course, people say, oh, well, that's not their function at all. Yes, the ministers are supposed to be the conscience of our society. But, of course, their remarks are muted in silence because, of course, it might be controversial. They might antagonize someone in the congregation, and they wouldn't put money in the plate. And we don't want to do anything controversial, do we? We don't want to stand for righteousness. You have to understand, ladies and gentlemen, we're involved in a terrible, terrible war over in Iraq. And somewhere between half a million, some people say 1.5 million Iraqis have been killed. You're never going to know the true number. In fact, most Americans don't even know about the Philippine-American War. What was the Philippine-American War? It took place in 1898 to about 1902. We killed between 200,000 and 1.5 million Filipinos. Go up on the Internet, go to Wikipedia, and read about the Philippine-American War. How would you possibly conceal something like that? Why, we have freedom of the press. When you own the press, you have the freedom to suppress whatever you want to. How would you suppress, for instance, our good friends in communist China, the fact that they murdered, starved to death between 1958 and 1962, somewhere between, 30 million and, I believe the actual figure is, about 41 to 44 million. That comes from a book called A Mother's Ordeal, written certainly by a friend of mine. We'd be glad to send you the pages. Those actually come from the Chinese own records. Most Americans have never heard of the Great Hunger in China. Why? Because, of course, we brought the communist Chinese to power, and we're subsidizing them today. Think about it, ladies and gentlemen. Why is the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund and the East Asia Development Fund and the Export-Import Bank and American corporations and banks transferring our wealth over to communist China? Very, very simply, because we brought them to power, we're keeping them in power. It's a great social experiment. What they have is an authoritarian government in charge, and of course, everybody else is under their control. And that's exactly what we're moving towards here in America, as we abandon our concepts of freedom and, of course, move increasingly towards an American police state. Now, certainly we hope that many of you will want, of course, to get my talk on the planned police state and get the syllabus that goes with it. We hope that you'll want to get my DVD on The Forbidden Secret, because, of course, you can't understand anything going on unless you understand the spiritual forces that are energizing our leaders and the people who control our media and our corporations, our banking system. So that is The Forbidden Secret, and there's a syllabus that goes with that. We do hope that many of you will want to get our four-tape set on concentration camps, or the DVD we have, America Behind Barbed Wire, or get the concentration camp special. And if you'd like, of course, clippings from the paper about how they have authorized $385 million, to be given to Kellogg Brown and Root to build concentration camps in America, we'll be glad to provide you with the articles out of the local newspaper about it. But you've forgotten, and you're not going to be reminded, because the last thing they want the American people to know is that in the name of fighting terrorism, and of course, opposing that wicked Osama bin Laden who's sitting in a cave over there in Pakistan, planning on enslavement, planning to take away our freedom, in the name of fighting Osama bin Laden, we are losing our freedom. And if you'd like to know the truth about Osama bin Laden, you go up and you Google in on your computer, Mrs. Bhutto, Gordon Frost. And of course, there's a video there. And of course, we're put in the word video, Google video, where Mrs. Bhutto, of course, tells Frost that bin Laden's been dead for several years. And of course, what happens? Very soon, she herself is assassinated. You're not supposed to get that sort of information out, but we have to have an enemy. We have to have an enemy because, of course, that is what they're using to justify the imposition of the police state. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And remember, we're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. Pray for America, but please, pray for Radio Liberty.